Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Our guest today is Dr. Beth Y. Carlin, Professor and Vice Chair of Women's Health Research in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Director of Cancer Population Genetics at UCLA's Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center and also the 2019 Giants of Cancer Care Award winner in gynecologic cancer. Dr. Carlin became interested in a career in medicine at the age of 15 when her grandmother died of breast cancer. Later, as a medical student, she committed herself to focus on gynecologic malignancies and hereditary cancer risk after a young woman dying of ovarian cancer questioned her own fate and caused Dr. Carlin to rethink her career. Her laboratory research contributed to the discovery of the serum biomarker HE4, which is FDA approved to help triage women with a pelvic mass and to help monitor women with ovarian cancer for possible recurrence. Her clinical research has focused on the susceptibility and clinical course of hereditary BRCA-associated ovarian cancers. Dr. Carlin has been at the forefront of clinical trials studying BRCA and other inherited mutations associated with increased risk for cancer. She currently serves as co-principal investigator on a national effort using a digital platform to implement population-based genetic testing for BRCA1-2 mutations in adults with Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. She remains clinically active and provides cutting-edge care for women with cancer and is committed to training the next generation of physicians and scientists. In the meantime, she's picked up a litany of awards and honors, including the Foundation for Women's Cancer Claudia Cohen Prize for Outstanding Gynecologic Researcher, the Rosalind Franklin Excellence in Ovarian Cancer Research Award, and even Mother of the Year from Helping Hands of Los Angeles. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Carlin. I noticed from your accent you are not a native Californian, so where did you grow up?
First, my pleasure being here with you today, Jason. This is really, I feel very honored to have this opportunity. I am a native New Yorker. I grew up in New York. My parents were from New York and may be able to take the girl out of the city, but you can't take the city out of the girl.
So a lot of bagels and coffee growing up. So growing up, had you always planned on being a physician or was it something you came to later in life?
You know, there were really no role models in my family. There weren't any physicians. I was always intrigued. I was sort of a math science kid, and that's where I had a natural aptitude. And I was always just fascinated by aspects of science. I've always innately had this, whether you want to call it a maternal sense, whatever, of really caring for others. And finding the kid who maybe was a bit out for some reason and wanting to include them, and just sort of this sense of creating community. And I think that resonated with the scientific questions I was asking.
So I know at 15, your grandmother died of breast cancer. And how did that change your life, both from a going into medicine perspective and just, you know, you're 15 and you lost your grandmother. What did that do for you growing up?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. My grandmother was someone who was very much a part of my life. And at times, through those teenage years, even closer than I had been with my mom. So I did feel the loss when she died in her early 60s. And it really made me pivot in terms of questions. What makes a cancer cell different from a normal cell? Yes, I was 15 and only had baby, you know, high school bio, et cetera. But we had looked at cells under the microscope. And I think began to really try to think hard about what makes the cell different. And that led me to seek out family, friends, et cetera, and get a job in a research laboratory, in a cancer research laboratory, where I could begin to think about unraveling those questions. Now, again, this is in the first half of the 1970s. So our understanding about cancers was really much more primitive than we had today, except that we knew that these cells grew unchecked. And I found that those questions in that environment and the constant ability to seek new truths and ask questions was quite seductive and really brought me in.
Do you know, or I guess what then was known about the idea of hereditary cancers? I know Henry Lynch started doing his research in the late 50s, but had that disseminated to the larger public at that point?
Again, I wasn't thinking that broadly at the time. I think what we've known for a very long time, that there were certain families where things ran in the family. And whether it's diabetes or heart disease, and to me it was cancer that I was thinking about. And indeed, I had a neighbor across the street from where I grew up who had died from ovarian cancer in her 30s. And I remember, you know, her kids were a bit younger than I was at that time. They were, you know, still in grade school. I was now in high school. But I remember hearing that she had multiple family members. So I think there was this idea, Henry Lynch's seminal work, just mapping these families, that cancer could be a trait that could be passed on from generation to generation and ran in families.
So, like I said, that's obviously a turning point in your life. What do you think you would have gone into had you not gone into medicine at that point?
It's a great question, because I think for all of us, when we reflect to say, if I wasn't doing what I'm doing today, what would I be? It changes over time. So if you would have said this to me in my 20s, I was very involved in theater and involved in production and putting on, you know, really coordinating the backstage part. I wasn't out front, but I really did produce theater through college and thought, wow, that would be very cool. I think what that anecdote says, I always liked coordinating activities in a way that would bring pleasure to others. So whether that today would be advocacy work, other types of leadership, things in public health, but clearly in a nonprofit type of space that is helping to bring people together to make the world a better place. Sounds so cliche, but, you know, in some minor way of planting that garden and allowing others to enjoy it.
I'm always fascinated by people who come from liberal arts and wind up in a math science field, because those skills don't often translate. It's rare to find people who are good in both liberal arts and hard sciences.
I never said I was good in liberal arts. I enjoy it. I love literature and art and museum. I mean, I'm more of a consumer with a great appreciation. Mm-hmm. And I think I use some of my skills in organization, coordination, leadership, motivation to bring together theater. So I produced opera, I produced Shakespeare, and it was really bringing together people who weren't math science folks, but I also learned from them and was a great outlet for me to share our talents and, you know, bake a cake with different ingredients.
Sounds like there's a lot of overlap for you now as a director of a cancer center and as somebody who runs clinical trials. It sounds like a lot of those skills translate.
I direct the cancer genetics program for the UCLA Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center. I work with an outstanding cancer center director in Mike Tytel, but I do have to coordinate many different constituents throughout this very, very large university and reach out to patients, physicians, physician scientists, genetic counselors, all others, to help coordinate efforts across cancer types and get people behind that.
Is there ever any opera singing that goes into that, or is purely behind the scenes?
I never said I sung opera. I occasionally in the operating room, though, I do like listening to classical music and to opera, but then there's always good closing music that tends to be just rock.
Whatever makes the surgery successful, right?
Exactly.
So I read, obviously, you know, you went to undergrad, then you decided to apply to medical school. And like I said, I was shocked of the naked sexism that you faced. This is, I'm guessing, about the early 80s when you're trying to get into med school?
Actually, it was the late 70s. But it did continue even to getting towards fellowship, where they said it wasn't worth their time to train women because we were going to just have kids and, you know, never practice and be able to follow things forward. you know, I always had this sort of Annie Oakley attitude of anything you can do, I can do better. So I was very fortunate to have, you know, supportive parents. And I met my current husband now when I was still in college. We're married 40 years. And along that way, as I would try these different things, he too believed that, you know, we could do this together, or I could do this, and was also very supportive. And I think that confidence in what I was doing really just helped me pursue my dream.
Part of the thing that surprises me is it's not as though it was unheard of for women to practice medicine at that point. And yet still the attitude was, you're just getting pin money almost. You'll just do this until you find a husband, and then, you know.
Yeah, that was right.
And you'll raise babies. And
yeah. I think that I helped change minds. I did have some of the people who made some of the most outrageous statements to me come back and actually apologize. Sometimes you need to let people who are different from you have opportunities and support them, because it really does make the whole so much better. In those days, it was women in gynecologic oncology. I don't know what came before me, per se, that made them not think it was going to be possible. I'm sure there was a good deal of sexism, of long surgeries, you can't stand up, you're going to be too tired or whatever. But, you know, again, I'm lucky to be healthy. I was able to do it. I worked really hard and really practiced, and, you know, would sit in front of the TV practicing tying knots and making sure I could tie, you know, 60 knots a minute and just keep going, and really hone skills that would, you know, allow them, if not accept me, not say that I was not capable for any specific reason. But there was, you know, even the nurses in some of the clinics would say, oh, they don't really like having you around. They only want the female, you know, the other fellows. You maybe should go do something else. So it was a whole culture at the time that needed to be changed. And I will say the feminization of medicine and of my specialty has transformed things in a way that has allowed more creativity, individualization, and really a welcoming of all individuals who want to have contributions in the space. Breaking glass ceilings or just being the first of anything, you often have greater scrutiny as you're compared to others. But it was something that I very much wanted to do and was willing to take on that added scrutiny in order to have the opportunity.
So, you know, now obviously you are a vice president at the Geffen School. You're a director of the Genetic Cancer Center. You know, you're a professor of medicine. You've you know, done some breaking of the glass ceiling on your own. Do you feel a responsibility at all to bring women along or make medicine a little more accepting to women as physicians?
I think that there's more and more good candidates. As there have been more women in medical schools, there have been more role models for women where they didn't have to feel that it was breaking a glass ceiling, but it was just something they could aspire to. I do feel a great affiliation to help support them, to help let them know that there are things that are just going to be biologically different. They choose to have kids, if they be pregnant, you know, there are things that are just perhaps tougher, but that they could do it. And that if they kept their eye on the prize, which to me was, you know, again, being a gynecologic oncologist, then it was doable. And that we all have our own path. We all have, there are potholes in the road, there are speed bumps, and they're different for everybody's, for each person's own journey. And I've tried to provide good counsel with really no prejudice, just sort of hearing what their stories are in order to allow them to have the opportunity. As I said, this feminization of medicine, I really think has allowed us to be a bit more flexible, that there are many ways to achieve that goal and really just some of the definitions of success for each individual as they pursue their own contributions to oncology.
Do you consider yourself a role model?
I've been told I am, and I take that title very, very humbly, seriously. I find a lot of pressure with it. You know, I go about my business and do what I do, and if that helps others believe in themselves because they see something in common or see something, you know, that inspires them, then I'm very glad to be able to do that.
Your motto is failure is not an option, but you know, in science, there's a lot of failure. In cancer treatment, there's a fair amount of failure. So, you know, how do you press on in the face of failure?
We have to continue to learn from each opportunity. You know, you start with science, you know, in the laboratory. You sometimes, when things don't work out, is where the greatest discoveries are. Believe the data, go and investigate it and see what's new there and what you can learn. From patients, it is difficult. At times, I think we know we are all mortal individuals. Cancer does not have prejudice. Cancer doesn't know there's a pandemic now. And so I promise each patient that I will do everything I can to provide them with the most cutting edge, compassionate care possible. We have to keep improving. And I think I wake up every, you know, CQI, I always, you know, one of my mottos is CQI, continuous quality improvement, that with each one of these disappointments, I will embrace that in a way to make it better for the next person.
So tell the story of the patient with ovarian cancer who forced you to rethink about hereditary cancers, because it sounded like that was a very, it was almost a slap in the face, a wake-up call to you as a young doctor.
On rounds, there was a young woman in her 30s, just a few years older than I was. And in those days, again, we didn't have outpatient treatment centers, so she was getting her IV chemotherapy in the hospital. She'd be there a number of days. And over my time on service, I got to know her a bit, would go back. I was naturally sort of attracted to her personality and thought I was befriending her in a way that a physician often does, just in terms of their relationship with the patient. And one day we were on rounds and I was presenting her, and she had had her own difficult night and basically sat up and looked at me and said, you know, what right do you have to stand there and pursue your dreams when mine have been stopped and I'm stuck here in bed dying from ovarian cancer? The question really resonated. I was younger. I think I really did take it to heart, recognizing how, as I said earlier, cancer is, you know, it's unfair, but the vulnerability that we all have, taking that mantle of trying to understand why these diseases happen to one person versus another, why they cluster in certain families, and really take that question as one that would then define, you know, one of the cornerstones of my own career as I think about what I'm still trying to do now in providing, you know, cancer genetic counseling and testing to all those who have cancer. Does it run in your family? Can we have a better treatment for you and also help identify those relatives who may be at risk and don't know it? And 90% of folks who carry one of these cancer-associated hereditary genes don't know it till someone in their family gets cancer. And can we truly intercept the cancer before it happens by identifying those individuals?
So from the perspective of patient care, it sounds like she really changed your perspective on what it meant to be a doctor and to treat patients.
Right, both what it means to be a patient and what it means to be the physician, and that those roles could be switched at any moment. She was someone I related to who could have been a friend if things were different. And I realized that we could all have these vulnerabilities and that we needed to be humble and do the best we can, just as if we want someone to be taking care of ourselves. And, you know, I still feel that very much in terms of how we care for patients and can think of them as not just as, you know, in this case, an ovarian cancer patient, but, you know, a sister, a mother, a daughter, a spouse, and all the other roles they have, despite just that one moniker of cancer patient, and how that cancer diagnosis impacts all their other roles as well. And keeping that in mind as we define and provide counsel to the patients with regards to the treatment options and next steps.
So is it easy to lose sight of the patient's humanity as you're treating them?
Never. There's different aspects of treating them. So really never. I mean, maybe technically in the operating suite, when you're doing a procedure you've done thousands of times before, but that pact you make with the patient that they are trusting you, that they're going to sleep with anesthesia and paralyzed and trusting you to care for them, I take as being really sacred. So I don't think it's, for me, hard to lose that sense of humanity. And I think it's part of what prevents burnout. You learn from each patient. You think how you can make things better for the next woman you see based on an experience you've had with the last.
You're the director, right, of the BRCA Founder Outreach Study?
Yeah, I'm one of the co-principal investigators. And, you know, that study is sort of, you know, winding down. We're now looking at those data and thinking about what the next step is. But I do think that the whole story where we started, you know, understanding families cluster with certain diagnoses, Mary Claire King and many others who did a lot of the work to identify where the BRCA gene is, and discover that gene, and then finding those, taking those basic science insights to get to a clinical test, to be able to test populations. And now we're sort of, you know, going to implementation science. How do we take the presence of the test, the knowledge of cancers associated with it, and get populations to want to get tested and then act on the testing results? Remember, there's lots of steps there to actually save the lives. Not only do we have to identify the gene, have a test, have it available, but then you have to have patients overcome their own perhaps fears and concerns to have the test and then get that information and act on it. But I think that whole story has led us to so many other halo effects because of doing prophylactic surgeries for women who had BRCA genes. We probably led to the discovery of the likely initial seminal lesion of most ovarian cancers, at least the high-grade serous ovarian cancers, of coming from the fallopian tube and not actually from the ovary. And that discovery has now led to new ways to consider preventing ovarian cancer. Understanding the BRCA gene's involvement has led to the idea of synthetic lethality and discovery of PARP inhibitors that have extended the lives of many women with ovarian cancer. And because of those applications, now have FDA approvals for other cancers, including breast, prostate, and pancreas cancer. So I think these insights of looking at the families, realizing this is a genetic trait, identifying the gene, getting a clinical laboratory test, getting people tested, looking at the pathology. It really is, you know, we talk about team science. These are discoveries that have come through pathology, through, you know, pharma, through laboratory science, through all sorts of groups working together that are really saving thousands of lives. And great to have even, you know, a footnote somewhere along the way in that.
I can really see you get excited as you talk about the study and all the things that could lead out of it. So women of color are obviously less likely to develop gynecologic cancers, but are more likely to die from the disease than white women. So, you know, how does medical science address that disparity? Is it screening? Is it just reaching the patients where they are? What needs to happen to address that disparity?
It's such a complicated and important question, Jason. I think first we have to accept that race is a social construct and that we need to help overcome the implicit bias that is present. We need to improve access, awareness. If you just look at, you know, cancer genetic testing, despite the fact that there may be higher carrier frequencies of some of these genes like BRCA in underrepresented minorities like Latina or Latinx and women of color, many practitioners don't recognize that and therefore don't offer the testing. Also in the community, so it's both sides. We have to get the information out to the communities that this testing exists and that it could help them and they would embrace it. So while many white women may say, hey, I hear there's cancer in the families and Angelina Jolie had this test and I want to have it, we need to get folks to recognize that, hey, Beyonce's dad had one of these genes too. And hey, this can affect all individuals and the information can be very empowering. I'm not trying to avoid your question in any way. I think that it's so complex that we need to improve access, but make sure the healthcare system is viewed as one that wants to care for all. There's trust, and for that we need to look at communities, community leaders, who are also part of the messaging, and ways to really democratize the information we have out into communities of color, that they can have access to those same state-of-the-art clinical care recommendations as does everyone else.
There is no simple answer then, as much as I might want to trap you into one. There's no.
I really wish there were, but you know, I've taken my implicit bias testing so many times and I do it again and again to remind myself things that, you know, I don't even realize may be implicit bias and a blind eye to me. And then I work really hard to overcome them. But there has to be a desire of everybody to want to embrace that as well.
So during your career, we've talked about this, you've both seen the rise of targeted agents and great improvements in screening. You've had a hand in some of the developments in treatment. So what do you see as the next great advancement in gynecologic cancers?
Well, what I hope will be the next great advancement is that we focus not just on developing new treatments, but on better ways to prevent cancer. I think even better than a cancer cure is never having gotten cancer at all, because it does change how you view your own vulnerability in the world. So intercepting cancer, I think for gynecologic cancers, the first beacon of hope is the HPV vaccination. And again, going back to the discovery and Professor Zurhausen getting the Nobel Prize for recognizing that the human papillomavirus can cause these, you know, cervical cancer cells to transform and become malignant, and as the etiology of cervical cancer, to the discovery with Dr. Lowry and others, to getting a vaccine that we now, if we can get folks to get the vaccine, and we still have to work a lot harder in this country to get boys and girls of color and white, you know, to get HPV vaccinated, we may be able to have this cancer, you know, love it to go the way of polio and not see much of it. I'm not sure we'll get that far, but we clearly can reduce death, suffering, loss of childbearing and fertility. I mean, there's many things we could do with that. I mentioned earlier with the BRCA work leading to the discovery of the likely cell of origin for ovary cancer that has been so elusive for so long, because most patients present with advanced stage disease. Now that we know where the ovarian cancers begin, we can again have ways to look to prevent ovarian cancers. For uterine cancers, which is the most common of all the gynecologic cancers and are rising in numbers, incidence, and mortality, understanding more about the different types of cancers, they're linked to obesity and looking at the general well-being of our population. So there's really a lot of ways to make us all healthier. And in so doing, that will help reduce the incidence and the numbers of women getting gynecologic cancers. And I think having greater focus on that direction is really the next frontier.
So finally, as we've talked about, you've got any number of accolades and awards, and you know, you've played a role in clinical research that has led to FDA approval for any number of drugs and treatment regimens. But what would you say is your greatest contribution to the field?
Grit and gratitude, meaning that I've done a lot of things that I'm very, very grateful for by just really believing in it and working hard. And having those opportunities to be able to be part of teams that have led to these contributions. So I think for me, it's, you know, I'm not sure role model is, maybe that's the, you know, title that people would put on it, but just showing others that believe in yourself, work hard, be open to others, listen. I mean, bringing in ideas and just showing how to walk the walk a bit. Yes, training the next generation, you know, having a balance between both my professional aspirations and my personal goals of raising kids, keeping my home life at peace, and just letting folks know that this incredible calling of healing of the medical tradition is something that needs all folks to contribute. And I think as a community, as our homes, we can all do it together and really improve the well-being of our society.
It's not too big of an ask, right?
No, I think we all need more kindness in the world these days. And I'm hoping that I can be a part and, you know, walk that walk and help show others and bring others along with me arm to arm to make that happen.
That's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Beth Carlin, and thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.